issue of my paper is to question the social and visual impact of these Hindu landmarks in a region which is obviously dominated by outstanding Muslim monuments. How did the architecture and the terracotta ornamentation of these Hindu temples integrate the regional heritage, Buddhist, Hindu, and Muslim? What self-image did the patron of the temples give through the iconography of the temples? My analysis will focus on one particular temple, the temple at Kantanagar, close to Dinajpur. You can see here, which is one of the most accomplished Hindu monuments of Bangladesh, dating from the 18th century. First, I'll concentrate on the general context, which is very important, and second, on the narratives. Many factors, either political, religious, or cultural, set the context of emergence of Hindu temples under this, the Mughal rule. I'll be, again, very brief, and sorry, on this point, which will be developed in my written paper. Before the arrival of the Mughals in Bengal in 1575, the region had underwent a long period of isolation and independence from Delhi court under the independent sultans of Bengal who ruled between 1338 to 1575. For the Hindu communities of Bengal, the arrival of the Mughals also followed the development of vernacular literary traditions which expressed a religious revivalism initiated by Chaitanya at the end of the 15th, early 16th century. His doctrine, based on bhakti and popular worship of Krishna, radically changed the current situation of Hindus of Bengal, which were weakened by Muslim leaders. By opening the path to of the divine to a wider range of the society, Chaitanya launched a movement which really contributed to the cohesion of the Hindu community of Bengal. The Kantanagar Temple, which is located in Dinajpur district, provides a good example of several aspects of the construction of Hindu temples under the Mughals. It was built in the 18th century, probably started around 1704, interrupted around 1722, and achieved in 1752 by the Dinajpur Raj, a Hindu landlord family, which possessed large territories in the Dinajpur area. An inscription on the south piece of the plinth of the temple states that Raja Pranath began the construction of a well-planned, graceful Navaratna temple of Rukminikanta. In order to fulfill the wish of Raja Pranath, the temple was completed by his adopted son, Ramnath, in his own town, Kantanagar, in the Shaka year 1674, which corresponds to 1752. This three-story temple, which is almost 16 square meters of Ratna type, once had nine turrets of Rekha design, which collapsed during an earthquake, earthquake in this region in 1897. And we are very lucky to have an image of this early state, which was published by Ferguson at the end of the 19th century. The patronage of this temple is also quite typical of the first period of Mughal reign. The Dinajpur family were very prosperous hereditary landlords, and as several other families of Hindu zamindar, like the Vishnupur Raj family or Birbhum Raj family, they enjoyed a certain independence in the management of their territories against the payment of taxes to the Mughal rulers. Pranath, the first patron of the temple, appears to have been a very powerful zamindar who not only maintained the ancestral property but did not hesitate to use force to increase the territories. A local legends record the origin of the foundation of the temple, erected to house an image of Krishna brought from Vrindavan by Pramnath himself while returning to a visit to Aurangzeb in Delhi. The choice and the place of the implementation of the temple on the banks of the Dipa River in Dinajpur district, although justified, of course, by the legend which involves the deities who choose this place, is eminently strategic, as most of the Hindu temples are from this period, it was erected in an area closely linked to a river, connected to a riverine trade, and at the same time adjacent, but not within, the houses from which the zamindar governed their estate. The leadership and management of the Dinajpur family is unquestionable, but the temple is conceived as a public and not a private cult monument, which plays a very important role in the local society. The construction of the temple at Kantanagar thus took place in a very ambitious context, where the prestigious monument acted as a visual symbol of the authorities of the local landlords in the area. If we now consider the broader architectural context, which is quite important, the construction of the temple of Kantanagar took place at a period when the Mughal rule was well implemented in Bengal. Dhaka, the new Mughal capital, for example, it established in 1608, was adorned with a number of palaces, mosques, forts and bridges. There were many Muslim monuments. But the contemporaneous Hindu temples, built in a variety of styles, common with Mughal architecture, had very little to share, on the contrary, with Mughal architecture. I won't be able to get into details but the Islamic architecture of the Sultanate period clearly played a very an intermediary role between earlier regional traditions, notably, for example, the terracotta tradition of decoration of Buddhist monuments, and the new temples, while contemporary Mughal architecture in Bengal rejected most of the regional features and imported new patterns. The temple of Kantanagar is dedicated to Krishna, as most of the Hindu temples from Bengal of this period, and expresses the popularity of the cult which was inherited by Chaitanya and his followers. Its architecture and decoration pattern are adapted to this new concept of cult, with the incorporation of a second or third story, which was intended to house the portable images of the gods, and a north-south axis for the community worship and ritual festivals, in addition to the conventional east-west axis. In fact, this new conceptualization of the temple, which has been analyzed by Pika Ghosh in her study on Vishnupur temples, is quite clear at Kantanagar. If we look at the decoration pattern, it can be only understood in this new optic, as both the Ramayana and Krishna narratives begin on the south face and continue on the side of the temple in a divergent way, which are both unusual visual features. And this new model has misled the author of the main monograph of the site of Kantanagar, Nazimuddin Ahmed, who wrote epic stories in terracotta depicted in Kantanagar, and who systematically described the terracotta decoration from right to left in a Pradakshina manner, starting from the south facade, and obviously found a number of inconsistencies, incoherent themes or incoherent narrative directions. He could not explain the sequences. The themes which are depicted on the facades of the temples do not show any particular innovations. They follow a codified scheme of decoration of brick temple of this type. I'll concentrate my analysis on the double base frieze, which is indicated here. The upper one devoted to mythological narratives and the lower one to the noblemen hunting and other leisure activities. In this very important iconographic world depicted on the faces of the temple, these friezes, as you can see here, are at eye level of the visitor standing in the courtyard, and they obviously provide a certain guidance of the devotee in his path around the temple. The narration process of the so-called social frieze, which is the lower one, is quite systematic. On each phase, the procession proceeds towards the center in an unchanging convergent pattern, except a few details. There are three main stages. First, the beginning of the procession, on the left here, you can see, with the nobleman, his assistants, and troop of animals. Then, the hunting action with details and of the fights of the animals. And third, the end of the hunting with the carriage of the dead animals. The part of the frieze on the central pillar of the temple are devoted to single scenes which are linked by the general theme, but disconnected from the main narration. The two base friezes are different from many aspects. However, it is almost impossible to dissociate them from a visual point of view. A certain parallel was intentionally made between the two worlds, the gods, the world of the gods, and the world of the noblemen. The interpretation of these visuals must also take into account the social context, of course, of the building of the temple and the ambition of the wealthy Hindu patrons in a society ruled by the Mughals. A closer look to the representation of the nobleman leisure world shows a number of characteristics. The zamindar here, for example, his relaxed and princely attitude contrasts with the activity and movement around him, the huge number of assistants and animals participating to the procession. The contrasts also plays on the costume and the ornaments. While the zamindar, who only wears a traditional Indian lower garment and few jewels, most of his assistants, the hunters, except the hunters, wear Mughal dress. And here you can see another category of people on the right, the Europeans, which are also part of the zamindar's world and which are depicted with standardized costumes. Finally, in this idyllic world, the zamindar seems the only one casually dressed. His wealth is displayed by his assistants, his accessories, his very richly caparisoned animals and vehicles. And curiously, as revealed by a comparative study at Kantanaga, the size and representation of the zamindar does not really interfere in his symbolic representation. The main character can occupy a lot of space in the scene and be carefully depicted, or, like here, be very smaller in size than his nearest assistants. You can see him sitting on the top of the elephant. It is his presence, his princely presence, indicated by a number of codes, the relaxed attitude, the casual dress, the smoking of the pipe, which is sufficient to evoke the leadership of the scene. In comparison with the pleasure world of noblemen, the world of the god is much more tormented. From a general impression, it is less regular and organized than the world of the noblemen. And in spite of the timelessness of the mythological tales, they seem at moment to be more realistic than the idealized picture of the nobleman world. The contrast between the wealthiness of the world of the zamindar and the world of the gods is even more striking on this part of the south facade of the temple, on the right side, where a tiny boat, there on the right, up, carrying Rama, Lakshmana, Vishwamitra, and a boatman on the Ganges, on their way on Mithila, is depicted above a big river boat of the zamindar. While Rama and the other characters are squatting on a very small boat, the zamindar below is comfortably enjoying a boat ride with his entertainments and a number of attendants. Obviously, the life of the zamindar is much more enjoyable. To summarize, the comparison between the social and mythological frieze of Kantanagar is significant of a number of points. In the temple dedicated to Lord Krishna and covered with terracotta figures, The representation of an ideal contemporary world of Zamindar occupies a very important place. In view of the surface decorated, this frieze is relatively modest, of course, but its position at eye level from the courtyard is eminently strategic. Another relevant aspect is its position just below the mythological frieze, a symbolic manner to claim the protection of the gods and to legitimize this way of life. From a content point of view, the mythological tales are far more rich than the Zamindar, which are repetitive and predictable. On the other side, the bigger size of the lower frieze, the dynamism, regularism, and rhythm of the action, the richness of the details, the prestige of the human and animal figures, all participate to the attraction of the eyes of the devotees and visitors. In the light of all these elements, an interpretation of the significance of Bengal Hindu temples in Mughal context can be attempted, with a special focus, of course, on this temple. After centuries of independence from the Delhi court, there was a need to express a regional identity. The development of Hindu temples in Bengal from the 16th to the 19th century is also closely linked, as we have seen earlier, to the cultural and religious revolution, the revival of Hinduism in a more popular form. The temples, through their architecture and iconography, also reflect the important status of the Zamindar in the local society, their participation to the trade activities, and their great ambitions. The importance of activity of patronage of temples by local landlords, carefully recorded in inscription, is significant of the recognition of the social and economic role of the temples, which attracted wealth, bound communities together through ritual activities, and asserted a local authority. But the aim of the patrons cannot be generalized. For example, in an inscription of the Mala king from Bishnupur dating the 17th century, the emphasis in the inscription is made on the new concept of temple, a house for the pleasure of Radha and Krishna, while the inscription on Kantanagar temple insists on the type of architecture of the temple and the name of the patrons. A shift which can be justified by the evolution of the relation of the patrons to the temple and the evolution of the cult itself. For example, at Kantanagar, although the temple is dedicated to Krishna, the iconography of the faces does not emphasize his deity. The themes are quite varied and the epics widely depicted. Another point is the occurrence of, in the 18th century, and more specifically in the 19th century, of European characters and their vessel ships. These symbols of the growing trading activities of Bengal, which are an expression of the changing of the society and the participating of the Hindu local rulers in the maritime trade to Europe and the Middle East, found a very unexpected place in the temple iconography. These European features combined to the Islamic architectural features of the temples obviously provide this type of Hindu temples with a cosmopolitan touch. It is interesting to see how the patrons and the builders of these Hindu brick temples identify themselves with some aspects of the cultural heritage and rejected some other ones. They adopted several features of the Islamic Sultanate architecture of Bengal and at the same time dissociated themselves fundamentally from the Mughal contemporary architecture. One of the reasons is the regional nature of the Sultanate architecture of Bengal, a cultural identity shared both by Muslims and Hindus. Another one is the linkage of with the rulers of higher rank to whom the patrons of Hindu temples identify themselves. There is also a will of continuity with the past, and since in Bengal the Hindu rulers are part of the distant past, the Hindu rulers, there were no Hindu rulers since the 12th century AD with the Senas, The closest models for these Hindu landlords in the 18th century is the Sultanate ruler. If we base our analyze on Kantanagar temple iconography, and if our interpretation is correct, the representation and self-identification of the zamindar is very clear. In the depiction of the standardized hunting processions, the zamindar act as princes surrounded by a glorious army. They copy the pastime and attitudes of the sultans and the Mughals while hunting, smoking the pipe, for example, and at the same time they claim their own identity. The use of Mughal dress is quite relevant at this point. At Kantanagar, the main character of the scene, the leader, is never dressed as a Mughal, but wears traditional Indian garment and is depicted on traditional river boats, a way to express a regional and indigenous identity. But again, this is not the case at Vishnupur in West Bengal, where elite figures are shown wearing Islamic dresses, a representation interpreted by Pika Ghosh as a way to establish their authority in the context of Islamic political preponderance in Bengal. At Kantanagar, the picture is quite different. The Mughal costume is often associated with the soldiers or bodyguards of the main character, which... I'm finishing. A judicious shift in the situation where the Hindu zamindars appear symbolically as the chief of the Muslims. The depiction of Mughal costume on Hindu brick temples have also been interpreted as an insignia of the prevailing aristocracy. But once again, on the friezes of Kantanagar temple, the figures wearing such costumes have subaltern roles. And if we presume that the patrons identify themselves with the idealized character of the leader, their message through the iconography seems quite clear. Thank you very much.
As we took five minutes, they started, we'll take 5 minutes into the tea break, so we have room for one or two, time for one or two questions.
Just a comment. Regarding the water pipe, it actually only became widespread through the Portuguese in the very last years of the 16th century, so it was not, could not possibly have been used by the previous sultans of Bengal.
Yes.
But on the other hand, it was smoking was forbidden at the Mughal court. And in the Deccan, quite significantly, you find the local rulers depicted smoking from the pipe in their own miniatures. And then when they become vassals to the Mughals, then they are depicted in a completely different way without the smoke pipe. So you find it with Rajput chieftains that were leading the Mughal armies, but you don't find it in Mughal iconography itself. So again, it's a sign probably of...
Thank you very much for Mark.
I just wanted to ask about the upper registers.
Yes.
In the context of who the deity apparently was, it's striking that the Ramayana receives as much emphasis as it does, and so the question would be why. I even found myself wondering about the Mahamantra, you know, Hare Krishna, Hare Ram, as I looked at the structure of the temple. That would be one. And then the second question would be, I guess like it, the Krishna sculptures go all around to the northern facade. Do they put the Ramayana when stop on the eastern facade?
Yes.
So there is an asymmetry there.
Yes, I can just come back quickly to this slide. Yes. Yes, it's asymmetric. There's more place for Krishna stories around the temple than for Ramayana. But the Ramayana is more clearly depicted also. It starts from actually from here, and with the beginning and goes up to here and continues like this. And this we find in other temples too.
One of the things that Pika Ghosh talks about in her book is the sort of explicit replication of Vrindavan in the Vishnupur temples. And there's a story about how the Zamindar actually gets his image in Vrindavan. Do we know anything about where the image came from and whether there's an explicit attempt to replicate Vrindavan?
The original image of this temple is lost. It is still under cult, but there are new images, and the temple is no more the property of the Najpur, of course, family. the system has been terminated after the partition of India. So now it's just a local community who worships, and nobody knows where the original idol is. And we have not much information about, it's just a legend of which has been recorded by the British, actually, when they came and they asked the people, and there's all kind of legend about the image which came from Brindavan. And another point, actually the situation seems very different from Vishnupur and from what Pika Ghosh says, because she speaks about, I think, the beginning of the concept, and at Kantanagar, which is much later, one century later, I think some of the original concepts have been perverted. For example, the Krishna, as I told you, iconography has not a very important place. I mean, here you can see only the base frieze, but if you look at all the decoration on all the faces of the temple, above the arches you have a depiction of Mahabharata, which is, occupies a lot of space, and we have not so the Krishna iconography is not predominant on this temple. So there must have been a shift and evolution of.
Yes. And she talks about how in the southern face of the Vishnupur, like it's in the Shravanavan, that you actually can see Kirtha being performed. But that, I take it, is absent here.
Yes, no, it's on the southern face you don't have this. You have big battles, and you have few depictions on the western face of the temple of Krishna dancing with the gopis, but just on the western face. On the southern face, there is no emphasis on Krishna, and this is different from Vishnupur.
Thank you so much.